www.mequarterly.org.
DB 860 AM Philadelphia Talk Radio, joined live with Robert Nicholson, the founder and executive director of the Philolis Project. Robert holds a BA in Hebrew Studies from Binghamton University and a JD and MA in Near Eastern History from Syracuse University, where he calls home. A former U.S. Marine and 2012-2013 TIKVA Fellow, Robert founded the Philolis Project in 2014. His and his organization's advocacy focuses on spreading the vision of a multi-ethnic and multi-religious Near East based on freedom and rule of law. He also serves on the board of directors of Passages and as a publisher of Providence, a journal of Christianity and American foreign policy. He's written in multiple publications, and we are glad to welcome him to Middle East Forum Radio today. Robert, good morning.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks for having me.
Of course, and thank you for joining us. This is the first in a series of interviews with individuals that I've come to admire through my work in the Middle East. Robert being someone who I've seen from afar, seen the progress of his organization as Christian Zionism and its advocacy for Middle Eastern freedom, especially those Christian minorities in countries beyond Israel's borders, but still close to the heart of Jerusalem, have been able to receive an advocate in the United States in the form of the Philolis Project. Robert, tell us about your personal journey. How did you come to form Philolis? What is Philolis, and what does the organization do?
Well, thank you for that question. That's a good place to start. So I was born into a Christian family, a Catholic family. I was baptized Catholic and grew up. I was born in Los Angeles, grew up in upstate New York, but myself was never really connected to the Middle East and personally had a lot of problems with my parents' religion, Christianity. So I kind of rejected all of that and set out on my own journey that took me through junior high, high school, joined the Marine Corps, enlisted there, served in the aviation side of the Marines. I was stationed out in Hawaii. This was in 1999. So there were worse things in the world. And left the Marines, sort of worked jobs like most people do, and felt like life wasn't going anywhere and had run into some rough patches and began to think more carefully about religion. And this was in the early 2000s when everybody was thinking about religion after 9/11, the invasion of the Iraq War. It was a very apocalyptic time. And I approached it very academically, you know, and started reading the Bible just out of curiosity and really just got drawn into it. And from there, as I sought to learn more and more about it, began to learn more about the Jewish people who had written it. I began to study Hebrew, began to study the region from which this Bible came from, and just was kind of drawn in a massive way. And it wasn't until maybe it was over a decade later that I actually started the Philolis Project. And yet, really what Philolis is in an unofficial way is my attempt to recreate that spiritual journey, going from a place of ignorance in the West all the way back East to where it all got started, and then to try to apply that experience or that realization in practical ways. Philos is a Greek word that means friend. And in thinking about the kind of the philosophy behind what I was doing, I realized that a lot of what I'm trying to do, it's, you know, to say that it's religious or say it's political is really to complicate it in a way that's unhelpful. And really what needs to be done, I think, in a lot of ways is create friendship. And the word friend is the way that we sort of nod to that, trying to build values-based friendships in between these two civilizations, you know, people who are like-minded, who believe in pluralism, who believe in strong bonds between East and West. Those are the friends that we look for and that we want to support in the region.
So what are some of the activities that Philolis engages with to be able to implement and execute its mission?
So the real, you know, we do a lot of things at the Philolis Project. It's an umbrella that encompasses immersive travel. We take people on trips to the region, journalists, policymakers, church leaders. It encompasses education. We have a lot of ideas and content-related material. It also encompasses kind of a network or community function. We have different chapters and cities around North America. We also do events and things like that. But none of those things by themselves are really what Philos is about. At the end of the day, Philos is about creating a new generation of leaders who will go into this space, this Middle East space, and try to make a difference. And so what we do with these trips and this content and all these other things is try to form leaders. And we really focused on the young professional category, people in their 20s, their early 30s, people who are coming out of college, beginning to figure out what it is exactly that they're going to do after the classroom. And we try to not only to train them for those positions, but even where we can try to help them get those positions through the relationships that we have. And so our hope is over the next 5 or 10 years to really see young Philos leaders in positions of influence, you know, having jobs like yours or in the State Department or the DOD or in church denominations, wherever the Middle East is being discussed, we want a Philos leader there. So there's a kind of a meta function, right? We're not necessarily lobbying directly, at least not always. We do some of that, but trying to create the people who will lobby for the things that we think are important.
And you've been able to diversify, like you said before, in sort of a network, if you will, of, let's call it a meta influence, not right now, but you're trying to inculcate and trying to address the educational needs of the next generation of individual Christians who are interested in, let's say, the national security space, the policymaking space, even those who are active in philanthropy, to offer the Philos point of view in American public policy decision making, depending on where the actual form is. Is there a policy agenda for Philos?
It is fluid. I'll put it that way. It encompasses the whole region and lots of different issues, and so it kind of moves within the policy space with more of a thought leadership role or a relational role rather than something that's very explicit and defined. Obviously, there are some things that are extra important to us, the security of Israel, the Jewish state, the security, safety, prosperity of Christian and other non-Muslim minority communities in the region in general, religious freedom, freedom of conscience, pluralism. And there are cases, there are specific regional issues, maybe we'll come to some of them here before the conversation is over, like Lebanon in Israel. That we take special interest in because it lies at the convergence of some of our different issues. So we don't have a kind of a statement of all of our policy points, but we do take them as they go.
Understood. And then, you know, sometimes you get to these policy points where, I mean, if we're talking about Lebanon and Israel, on one hand, you have a very, very strong U.S.-Israel relationship, which is multi-denominational. You have Christian interests. You have Jewish interests. Might I even argue there's a Muslim interest in having a strong Israel? Mm. And that's on sort of the U.S. side of the table. But then when we have to talk about defending minority communities in Lebanon, in this case, I guess we're speaking about the Maronites. There's also a unique political situation where you have a Christian community in Lebanon, which is sort of split, right? And mm-hmm. it's purely for domestic means because, you know, we're not talking about Israel here, U.S. national security policy. But in Lebanon, you're either for the Hezbollah government or you're against the Hezbollah mm-hmm. government. And yes, there's mm-hmm. this area in the middle. But how do you as an organization back here in the States educate lawmakers that and policymakers for that? That there is a difference, that, you know, you are sort of forced between choosing for one or the other. And then the fate of your potential church or your faith-based community is dependent on that choice. How do you guys like deal with those tensions?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. It's a long answer. I'll make it simple. We sort of take different cracks at it, right? So we will do things like travel. You know, we'll work on trying to bring people from our network to Lebanon to speak to people there, to influence them, to let them know how the U.S. is looking at this situation, and to do sort of a soft lobby in that sense. We also, you know, me myself personally, I just maintain lots of relationships and try to move things wherever I can. I think, you know, we also have a task force that's dedicated specifically to this this issue. I think the big problem that a lot of people have when it comes to these two countries, and it's actually symbolic for the problem that people have with the rest of the region, is that they don't look at it very deeply. They don't look at it historically. They don't look at it culturally. Lebanon, for not even just the average man on the street, but I mean, even a policymaker or a politician, is just a black box. You know, it's some Arab country. It's on Israel's border. There's tension between the two countries, but hey, why should we be surprised? Because Arabs hate Jews and Jews hate Arabs, and forever it was and forever it shall be. And no one bothers to really understand, you know, what is Lebanon? Where did it come from? Why was it founded? What is it? Who lives in this state? What are the differences, as you mentioned, between different political platforms? And really, once you understand that what you said is accurate, meaning there are a large chunk of people inside Lebanon who are against Hezbollah, who are against Iran, then you understand that the task is to try to, you know, drive a wedge essentially, between these two sides, and to help American policymakers understand there are good guys there, number one, and number two, how they can support them in ways that don't exacerbate the situation. So there's like a, there's like an educational aspect to our lobbying, right, if that makes sense.
Right. I mean, are you trying, in other words, to cultivate an anti-Hezbollah? Or let's not call it that, because I don't think that's like being too myopic, right? It's being too narrow. Are you trying to cultivate an anti-Iran, Iranian Shia extremist umbrella within Lebanon's Christian community that then can be an ally of the U.S. in its efforts to eject Iranian Shia extremist influence from Lebanon, and then the byproduct of that is maybe making them a stronger block against Hezbollah, weakening Iran, strengthening Maronite Christian minority groups?
Yeah, you could say that. I would probably describe it somewhat differently, just to maybe make it sound more positive. But also,
of course, I'm not one for the branding. I'm the analyst here, you know.
Well, I think, you know, people who understand the history of Lebanon understand that it's actually very similar to Israel insofar as it was founded for a very specific purpose, meaning the Christians of that mountain, Mount Lebanon, were looking to the French for, I mean, basically the Balfour Declaration for them that the British gave to the Jews. And the French gave it. And in 1920, actually, 100 years ago, almost exactly, this whole project got started. And while the territory was expanded to include Shia and Sunni Muslims, the real sort of point of Lebanon was to provide a safe haven for Christians in the region, even as these new Arab states began to get set up. And yet, very few people know that. You know, very few people understand that Lebanon is the closest thing to a Christian country in the Middle East. So what we're trying to do, yes, for sure, it's opposed to Iranian influence in the country by means of Hezbollah, but it's really just trying to make Lebanon get back to its founding purpose, to protect these Christians, to protect everybody who lives in the country, and get rid of these foreign influences. There was success in 2005 pushing out the Syrians, but the Iranians just remain this constant presence in the country, and somebody's got to do something about it. Bold action is needed ASAP.
So is that kind of bold action like trying to weaken Hezbollah-supported institutions? I mean, if we look at it now, Hezbollah has basically taken over the government in Lebanon. So mm-hmm. by extension, would that logic of doing something drastic mean cutting aid to the Lebanese army?
Well, that's one of the big questions right now, right? There's essentially two camps, as you know. One says, no, we have to save Lebanon. We have to pump more money into the LAF, the Lebanese Armed Forces, and the state to make sure that this whole project survives. And the other camp says that's the exact, we should not give them any money and let the whole thing collapse. It's the only way you're going to get rid of Iran. I have to say that they're both pretty compelling arguments, you know, and it's even though I probably lean more toward the let it fail, I'm worried. I mean, we could get into that, but I'm worried that obviously about the human cost of that, right? You can't just say that in a cavalier way if you care about the people of Lebanon, which I do. My concern is that that bold action so far within Lebanon is non-existent. You know, there are a lot of good people in Lebanon who would share our worldview, many, many, probably more than 50%, but no one's willing to put their life on the line, or not enough people, in order to dislodge this foreign entity from the state's politics. You know, you have a UN force there, UNIFIL, also seems unable to dislodge Hezbollah. The U.S. really hasn't done all that much. I think the Israelis even, you know, they'll cross the border and mow the grass, so to speak, to keep things in check, you know, bombing weapons depots and all of that. But they, you know, even they know that, like, there's a lot to be lost by going in and just, you know, raising everything to the ground. So what do you do? You know, if no one's willing to act, and yet we all know what the problem is, how do you stop this? How do you stop the problem? And so that's where these people come in and say, look, just let the whole thing collapse. The more, you know, this Lebanon has stage three cancer, essentially. And if you give it aspirin, all you're going to do is fool the body into thinking everything's okay. If you give them money, you're actually propping them up, right? You're giving them CPR. It's better just to let it die and then protect what needs to be protected and prepare for another day. Now, I don't go that far, but I understand the argument, and I think there's something about it that's compelling. And if you buy it, it actually will change your strategy. Then it becomes less about, you know, how do we prop this thing up, to how do we protect what's most important inside the country in the event of collapse, so that it can rebuild on better foundations the day after. It's a very, very hard question.
I understand. And you know, the beautiful thing here is you're saying this and I'm typing away, trying to figure out, you know, what some of the other issues dealing with Hezbollah and with the situation of Christians in the country. And in preparation for this interview today, we looked at some of the things that you've written in the past. And this is, I think that it looks like your position's evolved. There's an article that you wrote in Newsweek in September of 2017. A fascinating perspective by Robert Nicholson, talking about the tension within Lebanon and how it may require a Robert, I wouldn't say that you're advocating for a complete, you know, massive shakeup in Lebanon, but it might be getting close to that situation. Correct with that?
Yeah, it's not, and this is important to state. I'm glad you came back to it. You know, I think the wrong way to think about this is to say, let Lebanon collapse, right? It's inhumane and it's ill thought out. But to recognize, as I do, that it's very possible, in fact, maybe even likely, that this regime will collapse, not because, you know, we or anyone else does anything to it, just the combined pressure of economics, of politics, of Hezbollah's amassing of more and more weapons and more sophisticated weapons, it just will implode. And to take this path says, look, it's probably going to happen, if not sooner than later. Are we prepared for that moment, or will this just be a failed state? And again, if you care about minority rights in the Middle East, and particularly of Christian rights, that's a pretty fearsome scenario. So I think that it's not for lack of concern for the Lebanese that one says, let's think about the possibility of collapse. That's where I'm at, is that we can't, you know, because of our own wishful thinking, pretend like this is not a possibility. On the contrary, we have to be ready for it and think about what would that mean for the country.
Right. And this is a very different situation 3 years later versus when that article you wrote came out. I finally got the title. It was Israel and Lebanon, a Path to Peace, led by Trump. Mm-hmm. And just in the last 3 years, I mean, look at everything that's happened. The guy who was responsible for Iranian influence in Lebanon is no longer with us. Mm-hmm. But the problems are still there. You wrote back then with Nassif The problem is that Hezbollah's opponents inside Lebanon receive little backing from forces outside Lebanon. Neither Aoun, Mike Michel Aoun, the president of Lebanon, nor the Lebanese armed forces are powerful enough to disarm Hezbollah on their own. It is likely, however, that dedicated assistance from allies outside the country would embolden them and bring their opposition to Iranian influence to new levels. Currently, the United States supplies arms and training to the LAF, the Lebanese armed forces, but in order to strengthen a state, that assistance needs to be substantially increased. The LAF is the most stabilizing force in the country and remains neutral in the country's sectarian squabbles, making it a natural starting point for the level of support and engagement needed for Lebanon. It sounds like now that Hezbollah has taken over, has that ship sailed?
I think you're right that my position's evolved a bit. 2017, even though it was just a few years ago, was a different situation. Since then, Hezbollah has gone on, as you said, to acquire even more influence. And I'm a little more pessimistic today than I was then. And it is ironic, as you mentioned, that this all comes after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard commander. I think we all expected that some of these things would get a little bit better, but it's been a few months now and things seem to persist. And I, you know, just to the point about American leadership, you know, you mentioned the article's title included led by Trump.
Right.
I think Trump and the U.S. in general has a really important role to play and should step into this space with all of the kind of all of the muscle and the energy that lies between or lies within our Near East Policy Bureau, and make this the centerpiece of our work in the region. I think for me, I think we've seen that we're getting diminishing returns from our engagement with some places more far afield, like in Iraq is the obvious example, but you can name any number of countries in the Middle East where America either has been ineffective or doesn't have the political will to stay involved long enough to actually change things. I think Israel present unique exceptions in America's engagement with the Near East because, you know, it cannot help but be true that a Jewish state and, you know, a quasi-Christian state would resonate for America, you know, a country founded on Judeo-Christian principles, more than, say, the civil war in Yemen or, you know, what's happening in the Gulf. There's something about these two countries that should make us do more there, right? And I think we have the ability to do more there. I think we have more friends in these countries. And Israel, obviously, is an easy one. The vast majority of Americans are supportive of our work there. But I think the people haven't been educated, or the policymakers, or some combination of both, to see that Lebanon is more or less the same thing. And by the way, all of our regional interests converge there, right? Our support for Israel on Lebanon's border, our concern for energy in the region, and you've seen the discovery of natural gas deposits offshore in Lebanon, the Sunni Shi'i conflict, the Iranian influence, the whole cause of religious freedom, peace, coexistence, all of it is in Lebanon. And I would say to wind down some of our extraneous engagement in some of these other countries where we're getting diminishing returns and focus on Lebanon. And I think given the proper amount of U.S. investment, not just in terms of money, but in terms of influence and power, the situation in Lebanon could be turned, absolutely could be. But so long as we're keeping this situation on kind of a low flame, it's not getting any better and it's actually getting kind of worse. So I'm a guy who calls for very robust U.S. engagement with Lebanon is just as much within our national interest as Israel.
Right. And what that looks like is, I think, up for debate. Maybe after we get done with the coronavirus pandemic. And that's the point that I want to talk to you about next after these messages. Welcome back to WWDB AM 860 here in Philadelphia with Robert Nicholson, the president of the Philos Project, speaking to us about Middle Eastern minority groups, the necessity for Americans to defend its interests in the Middle East, especially those of different faith-based communities, Lebanon, Israel, and other countries and topics we'll get back into now. So, Robert, we were just speaking about the necessity, or you're advocating for the necessity of maybe the U.S. doubling down in Lebanon, perhaps even at the expense of some of its other foreign policy forays in the region, which have not produced results. But I'd like to take this moment to pivot for a second to a more humanitarian topic, which is the role of the United States in helping the Middle East overcome the coronavirus. We have seen devastating drops in oil prices. We have seen the U.S. somewhat limited in its outreach to bases in Lebanon, not in Lebanon, in the Middle East. I mean, it's kind of confined to Qatar. It's confined to the UAE. We've seen an uptick in Iranian aggression in the Gulf. Is there a special need for the U.S. to intervene in any Middle Eastern country, even with these disaffected minority groups who may be suffering disproportionately to the majorities in the Middle East because of the coronavirus pandemic? Are you seeing anything different now than before this virus started, especially how it's affecting minority groups?
Well, that's a good question. And you know, I have to say that as much as we've been trying as an organization to follow this and to figure out how exactly it's affecting each group, you know, not only each country, but each sort of group within each country, especially those of minorities, it's very unclear. The coronavirus has us all in disarray, right? And so it's kind of hard to figure out exactly what's going on. And I think that no one has, in any kind of systematic way, assessed what all of the needs are. I think, you know, we were just talking about Lebanon. You see in some countries like Lebanon, where the coronavirus pandemic has just added fuel to an already raging fire. I think maybe Lebanon would be the clearest example of a place where the U.S. should use the COVID moment to be a little bit more involved, just because the conditions already before the pandemic were so precarious. But there are other places as well. Obviously, you have thousands of minorities, Yazidis and Christians, who are still living either in special refugee camps just for them, or more likely scattered in the slums of various cities across the Middle East. And no one exactly knows what their needs are. Do they have coronavirus? Do they not? They belong to different churches. So while their church leaders may know, lots of the church leaders are not talking to each other. So there's a lot of unknowns here. But I do think that in the broad picture, the U.S. should use this moment to reaffirm its commitment to the region. Now, I think that overall, as a country, we need to do a better job of leveraging our aid, right? We do these things all the time, all over the world, where we, you know, some hurricane comes or an earthquake, or even preventative situations where we're trying to raise levels of education and literacy and healthcare. But I don't think we do a very good job of trying to use those things to achieve our policy goals. And I think before we do a cannonball in the COVID pool, just say, let's really pull out all the stops and go out there and help people. We need to figure out what it is that we are trying to accomplish and then try to match up that assistance to those ends. Again, Lebanon's a great example. I think Egypt could be a good place to get involved more with COVID. But beyond that, it's still so early. It's hard to tell where we should go from here.
So that's as it relates to the Middle East. But let's focus back on the United States for a second. I'd like to go back to the Philos Project and some of its different, I want to call it appendages. I'd call it sister organizations or partners who are involved in this effort, specifically as it relates to Israel and also the wider Middle East issue. Would you guys categorize yourselves as being a pro-Israel organization or as a Zionist organization, or are you more a wider regional focused organization? I mean, how do you guys go about defining yourselves?
Yeah, we're regional. We talk about the Near East. I think I could go on a whole speech here about the Near East and even why the title Near East is important, or at least signifies something unique about certain parts of the region that are especially connected or special to the West and therefore merit deeper engagement. Again, Lebanon and Israel are perfect examples. But even though we are regionally focused, Near East focused, we're pro-Israel, if that means supporting, you know, the right of Israel to exist and be secure. Zionist, yes, if Zionism means, you know, Jewish nationalism and nothing more. I think sometimes right.
You're going to see why I'm bringing this up in the next question. So
okay, yeah, obviously it's a loaded term, but very much. I actually would go even further than that. I think that Israel, as a project, meaning this national movement of the Jewish people to reestablish its sovereignty, is perhaps the best thing that's happened to this region in the last 100 years. And I think that it serves as a catalyst. It serves as a model, even in some cases, for what could happen in other parts of the region. You know, Israel is in some sense, at least for an American or for a Westerner, it's a gateway to the region, right? It's because Christianity came from there and because Jerusalem's there, people sort of look at Israel in a different way than all those other places. And I think that presents a unique gateway for people outside to engage with the region as a whole. So it's not the region on one hand, you know, Israel on the other. It's how can we use Israel as that doorway, that portal to get Americans to care about Israel's neighbors and all of these other groups that we're talking about.
Right. So it's sort of the gateway into that larger conversation about the Near East that you had just mentioned. But I want to look at some of the, I don't want to call it internecine disagreements within the American Christian community as it relates to Israel. But if we could just briefly map the, would you guys consider yourselves to be a multi-denominational Christian organization, or is it evangelical or Protestant or Catholic? How is it in terms of the denominational definition?
Yeah, so we're non-sectarian. Our baseline is the Nicene Creed. For those of you who know, it's the fourth century kind of statement of faith of the church. But we have on our staff and among our fellows, we have the whole gamut, you know, not even just Catholic and Protestant, but these Eastern churches that are neither Catholic nor Protestant. And we try to create, and that's one of the things I wanted to do with Philos, was to say that, yes, there are many evangelicals who talk about Israel and the region, but this isn't only an evangelical party. You know, anybody who kind of subscribes to the broad package of Christianity should find this region uniquely important to them and should commit to be engaged with it.
And how does this differentiate with, let's say, an organization like CUFI, Christians United for Israel and Pastor John Hagee, or Eagles Wings and Pastor Robert Stearns in New York, south of you in Buffalo? What's the difference between those organizations, which I guess self-define as pro-Israel Christian organizations, and Philos? And because what I've seen is you guys, you have a journal. There's a think tank that you're involved with. You guys are in D.C. You are now bringing American Christians to Israel on this Passages program. Seems like it's very diversified. What's the difference?
Yeah, well, I think that's one. We have just a lot of different components, right? Like some of those organizations will take trips, and some of them will do, I don't know, I guess you call them kind of rallies for Israel. So structurally, I think we're very different in that we have trips, but also events and content. There's just a much broader range of activities. But even I think philosophically, you'll find a difference, and probably the more important difference. And it's less a difference of ends and more a difference of means. So if I understand CUFI and Eagle's Wings correctly, they support more or less what I just said a few minutes ago about the right of Israel to exist in security next to its neighbors.
Right.
But they go about it a very different way. You know, it depends on which organization you look at, but the organizations you're talking about usually have a very specific I guess you could say a theological proposition, right? That there is a very clear list of verses, a very clear list of doctrines that
this is a dispensationalist Christianity.
Yeah, not only, but yes, primarily that requires you as a Christian to support this state for religious reasons, right? And if you don't, then you are ipso facto, you know, against God. Now, Philos does not look at things that way. There are people in our network who see Israel as holding theological significance. There are people in our network who absolutely 100% think Israel is theologically insignificant, but still, for kind of historical and cultural reasons, think there is a moral justification for caring about Israel. So, you know, I sometimes say that when it comes to Israel, even though that's not our only issue, there's lots of on-ramps to the highway, right? And people take
tell
different
me about
on-ramps,
it.
And I don't really care that much which on-ramp you take, as long as you're on the highway. That's just fine with me.
Everyone has their own narrative and their own story about their Israel-oriented engagement. Mm-hmm. But as long as, like you said, they're in the right direction, then everybody can join up and together. How does that mesh, though, with organizations that claim to have a Christian character? For instance, Churches for Middle East Peace and Mae Cannon. She's been popping up on my Twitter feed for the last little while just because of some of her work. And what seems to be a lot of activity. Also, you have the Telos program. You have what's it called? The mainline Protestant. I'm going to forget what it is now, but mainline Protestant churches, which often have these conventions about boycotting Israel. I mean, all of that and together, how do you reconcile that there is this non-sectarian, multi-denominational Nicene Creed agreeing group called Philos? And you guys are very, very on the in favor of the U.S.-Israel relationship side. But then there are other, I don't want to say other churches, but other streams of thought regarding the U.S.-Israel relationship, the status of Palestinian Christians, that come out on the exact opposite side of what we're talking about right now. How do you reconcile those two things?
Well, it reflects essentially a long tradition of disagreement within Christianity about the Jewish people and where they fit. You know, Jesus comes. Up until the point when Jesus comes, the Jews are God's chosen people, right? This is what is written in the Bible. And yet the Jews, or let's say the majority of them, don't accept this person, Jesus. And for centuries and century after century, Christians have been trying to figure out what happened. Like, why did the Jews reject Jesus? And what does that mean for their place in God's economy, they sometimes call it? Are they in? Are they still chosen, or are they out? Are they still, in some sense, the people of God, or has the church, the people who did believe Jesus, replaced Israel? And they call that replacement theology or supersession, that we Christians have superseded the Jews, that they just have no role whatsoever in this story. And so it's not surprising that there are groups that take that approach. In fact, that has been, I would say, the majority approach for Christianity, for Christians, for, you know, almost 2,000 years when it comes to the Jewish question. And I recognize that that's a valid Christian position. The difference maybe between me and somebody from Christians United for Israel on this point would be that I wouldn't then call that person a heretic, right? I don't think it makes them unchristian. But I do think it makes them ahistorical. And that's kind of the common thread that I find among all of those different groups that you mentioned, and that kind of philosophy as a whole, is it approaches the question of Israel ahistorically, aculturally, as if Christians and Jews have as much to do with each other as Christians and Burmese, right? That the Jews are not special. They're just like every other people. And in fact, maybe if they are special, they're uniquely evil, right? Because Jesus was theirs and they rejected him. There's like a special stain on the Jewish people that comes out in some of these arguments of these people, you know, why they care so much about what is happening in a Jewish town in Judea or Samaria and not about the Syrian civil war that's raging, you know, a couple hours away is beyond me, right?
The hypocrisy, the hypocrisy is unbelievable.
100%. I mean,
the reason I brought up Cannon is because, are you familiar with May Cannon in Churches for Middle East Peace?
Yeah, I know May. Yeah, I do.
Okay. So I don't know if you guys have a relationship, friendship or whatever. I don't want to impugn upon her character, but I was trying to gather some examples for this question. I mean, even in these prayer meetings, which she has sometimes, they bring Palestinian Christian leaders who are often known for invoking blood libel, anti-Semitic remarks, tropes. And it's, you know, the one specific one that I'm looking at is an individual named Mitri Rahab, who was known specifically for their anti-Semitic remarks on social media. If we go to Palestinian Media Watch, an organization led by Itamar Marcus in Israel, he often profiles this individual. And I don't understand how they can reconcile saying that they're for Middle East peace while at the same time making remarks themselves, and then in addition inviting speakers who are known anti-Semites to address their gatherings and their conferences. It just befuddles me.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't know about that particular example, but it's not uncommon at all to find people who preach peace and yet when you listen to their words are calling for ostracizing another group of people. And I've found even in this space, and I know many of these people in a personal capacity, that just interpersonally, they're not the bridge builders that they sometimes pretend to be, right? They want to build bridges with everyone but me, because I think it's okay that the Jews have a country in their homeland. And even, you know, and I've made pretty aggressive efforts, and this is something I've taken a lot of hits for from people who are part of the sort of so-called pro-Israel crowd, is I actually seek these people out intentionally to say, listen, you know, reasonable people can disagree. I'm a pragmatic person, and we should like sit down and talk about, you know, why are you having this position?
This is the like love thy neighbor approach.
Yeah. And it doesn't really go anywhere, I think is the bottom line. And these people, you know, the rhetoric that they put out there masks a pretty specific agenda, which is to undermine the state of Israel. And they, you know, I don't think these people, you know, are looking for genocide of the Jews or throwing the Jews into the sea. It's not as insidious as that. But they, on the pretense of following Jesus, believe in this, you know, ooey gooey Christianity that makes no distinctions between anything, right? Everything's the same and everything's equally loved and appreciated and respected, except for anything that tries to draw a distinction. And Zionism drew a distinction. It said, this is a unique project for the Jewish people to protect them in their homeland. And that's seen by these people as divisive and as something against the universal spirit of Christianity, at least by their lights. So, you know, we do a lot of work trying to educate people. You mentioned passages. This is a program we founded a couple of years ago to bring large numbers of Christian college students with leadership potential on 9-day trips to Israel for only $500.
Is this sort of like the Christian birthright trip?
Yeah, in a way, it's sometimes called the Christian birthright, actually, but it's because of all of what we're talking about, right? There's a whole generation of kids coming up in homes where the parents don't know that much about any of this. They go off to college, they start taking classes, they hear that Israel's bad, America's bad, Christians are bad, right? And so a lot of what this program is trying to do, first of all, is just reconnect these kids to the origins of their faith. And it's a very powerful experience for them. We've taken about 10,000 in just a few years.
Wow.
And we think it's going to be, it's going to address some of these problems that we're talking about inside the church. This bad tendency to favor everyone but the Jews.
Well, Robert, I appreciate you joining us this morning on Middle East Forum Radio. Is there any way that we can find out more about your organization, its different partner organizations, and hopefully maybe we can have you back soon to talk a little bit more? I feel like we only got halfway through the conversation today. There's a whole lot more that we can discuss, maybe even making it a two-part interview. But how sure. can we find out about Philos?
Yeah, so philosproject.org is our website. Obviously, we have all the social media that any other organization has, so look at us on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all of that. And then for those interested in Passages, this program I was just talking about, the trip for college students, that is passagesisrael.org. And you'll find on that website how one goes about applying for that trip and getting on it. Obviously, coronavirus has us all on pause for now. Those hopefully will be picking back up. Those
you know what it's going to do? It's going to make your waiting list grow larger. That's the only issue they have to deal with. Robert Nicholson, president, founder of the Philos Project, well-educated American advocating for Christian rights in the Middle East and a stronger U.S.-Israel relationship. Thank you for joining Middle East Forum Radio this morning.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you.
And that's all for this week here on MEF Radio. We'll be joining you next week with our guest that will be announced on Friday at emmyforum.org. Have a great day, everybody.